From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, federal workers picking up where they left off before the shutdown.
The morale is not that great, let's put it that way. People are suspicious that we'll be furloughed again in 3 weeks, and nobody's gotten paid yet.
Yet some in Congress are preparing bills to keep another shutdown from happening.
As part of this equation, to tell the White House and the Congress that they're not going to get paid, not a problem.
How Henry Ford's strong anti-Semitic views of a century ago are fueling hate groups in 2019.
They're sort of like using the fact that this great American is validating the views that they hold in 2019.
And the humongous fungus of the UP.
Now we know that it's at least 2,500 years old. It weighs at least about 440 tons.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A lot of schools are closed because of snow and cold today, but only one school's announcement went viral. In a video sent out to students, Swartz Creek Community School Superintendent Ben Meinke and high school principal Jim Kitchen told students they had the day off, but they said,
"We're not going to humiliate ourselves by singing a snow day song."
And then you hear a piano begin to play the melody for Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah.
I heard about a winter storm. It's cold and dreary. Stay home, stay warm. It's cold and it's a snowy winter morning. It goes like this. When the snow hits, the buses can't get out of it. It's cold and it's a snowy winter morning.
Now, this video of Meinke and Kitchen's snow day performance has racked up nearly 100,000 plays on YouTube so far, and I'm sure we are not the only ones waiting to see what this team from Swartz Creek will do for an encore. And after a long 35-day break from their jobs, many government workers are back in the office today as well, taking down old holiday decorations, blowing dust off their desks, and in many cases, wading through thousands of emails that stacked up during the partial government shutdown. Among those 800,000 employees finally back on the job is biologist Dave Fanslow. He's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, working in its Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, and he is president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 3908. Dave, are you back at work now? Is everyone back?
Yes, we're back on the job, Cynthia.
How does that feel? What's the mood?
Well, it's a mixed bag. Everybody's really excited to be back and trying to get caught up, figuring out what data we're missing, what needs to be done, kind of triaging. And on the other hand, the morale is not that great, let's put it that way. People are suspicious that we'll be furloughed again in 3 weeks, and nobody's gotten paid yet. We've been promised to be paid on the 31st. For our two missed paychecks, but nobody has been paid yet.
And we've been hearing so many stories of workers who are really questioning whether they want to keep working for the government and realizing that they could be used the way that they've been, that you all been for the last, for those 35 days.
Yeah, that's right. Well, what I'm hearing from like our top scientists is that they're already sacrificing a pay premium for working at the government, but what normally compensates them is their sense of mission, is their commitment to doing what the public has asked us to do in terms of studying the Great Lakes and getting the data that helps us to safeguard them better. And right now, the way that they're feeling, you know, lack of support from the administration for that mission, it really is hurting morale.
So, Dave, what was the result of all of the weeks of inactivity? What has been lost?
Well, that's what's being figured out this week. So our folks who look at meteorological data, who collect data to supplement models like our circulation model, like our ice forecast model, they're going through all of the computers right now and looking to see what's been lost and where they can kind of do a seamless restart of the models and get everything back up and running. The guys that do that have told me that by the end of the week, they should be able to have the circulation model, for example, back up to full speed.
What was the personal toll from not being paid, missing two pay periods, not being at work. What did that do for you?
Well, it really stressed everybody out. You know, we haven't been paid yet. So people are late. People are normally conscientious about paying their bills, and we can't do that. Additionally, we can't pay our government bills right now. So, you know, we contract out a lot of services with small businesses locally to provide our laboratory, and our purchase cards are frozen as part of the shutdown. So I can't pay vendors. I can't pay the compressed gas company that supplies our laboratory, for example. We can't pay our water purification service. You know, we can't pay companies that do calibration and maintenance on instrumentation. So those small businesses are all out there waiting and so far being gracious, but it's not good for them.
During the partial shutdown, the president and some of the top members of administration made comments like, you know, the president saying, if people aren't being paid, go talk to your grocer, talk to your bank. They understand. They'll work with you. We had Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross saying he didn't understand why some government workers had to go to food banks. I guess thinking about another possible shutdown, what would you like to say to comments like that?
Well, that attitude was probably the most disturbing thing about this because it just shows that they lack an understanding of the human element, and it shows to me that on one hand they're willing to use the government employees as pawns, they're willing to compromise our mission readiness and sabotage our mission readiness, frankly, and on the other hand they're repealing sanctions against Russian oligarchs for billions of dollars. And so it really sends a message that they don't support the core mission of the American government. And it's a pretty disturbing attitude.
Dave, through the 35 days when no paychecks were coming in, were your creditors understanding? Did people cut you slack because you were a furloughed federal employee?
Well, I was fortunate to have a cushion. I have other folks, though, that I've been working with who have been talking to creditors, and, you know, we've kind of offered to loan money through our union, and some folks have had to borrow money from family members. But so far, what I'm hearing is that everybody is being gracious and considerate, and knowing that it's finite, you know, assuming that we will get paid at the end of this month. We still get paid the end of this month, then people can pay their January bills.
But then February 15th, that clock is ticking pretty quickly to the point where you could have another furlough. Is there anything you can do to prepare for that?
Well, what the union is advising everybody to do is to save every penny they can between now and then. When they get this back pay the bills they have to pay. Don't pay things that can be deferred and assume that there will be another furlough just to be as prepared as possible.
Dave Fanslow is with NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab in Ann Arbor, back to work after that 35-day partial government shutdown. Thanks so much, Dave.
You're welcome, Cynthia.
Consumers Energy has been coming under fire in recent years for the amount of money it's spent to influence Michigan politics. Now, in an unprecedented move, the Michigan Public Service Commission is reining in the utility company's political spending, at least temporarily. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton's following this story. Tracy, bring us up to speed. What exactly has Consumers Energy, the state's largest utility, been doing?
They have been contributing a very large amount of money to a nonprofit political advocacy group. It's called Citizens for Energizing Michigan's Economy, so you don't know what they're about, right? Mm. So this group is one of those so-called dark money PACs which can spend unlimited sums on political advocacy without disclosing their donors. And last year we learned that Consumers Energy is basically paying all the bills for this group. They've given it more than $43 million since 2014. to advocate on issues on their behalf.
You know, $43 million sounds like a lot for utility to be spending on politics, is it?
It is. Energy and Policy Institute, which is a utility watchdog group, found that was the same amount of money that all utilities across the country spent on political activities between 2015 and 2017.
All right. So we've established it's a lot of money. What are some of the issues that this dark money group is spending this money on?
Well, in 2014, they poured millions into a campaign to defeat legislation that would have opened up Michigan's electric market completely to competitors. That would have lifted the current 10% cap that competitors can claim customers from Consumers Energy and DTE Energy. That campaign was successful. Last year, they poured millions more into defeating Republican State Representative Gary Glenn in a primary. He supported a deregulated electric market, and they succeeded in that effort, too.
So Glenn was defeated.
Yes.
And what, did they try to target any other politicians?
Yeah, two others, but they were not successful there.
Okay. But this is not illegal, right?
It's not. It's not against state or federal law for a regulated utility to use its funds to advocate for positions or candidates, but I have to wonder if the amount of money that Consumers Energy was spending sort of caught the eye of the Michigan Public Service Commission. And the utility agreed it will not spend any more money on these dark money groups for the next 2 years.
Okay. Now, is this the first time that the Michigan Public Service Commission has kind of cracked the whip and done this kind of thing?
It appears to be the first time that any state utility regulator has done this. I talked with Matt Casper of the Energy and Policy Institute, and he thinks people in other states are going to be taking note.
And it won't be surprising to me if we see advocates or interveners in other states take this precedent that the Michigan Public Service Commission did and try and replicate that maybe in Arizona or Florida, other states where you have large monopoly electric companies spending millions of dollars to influence races.
Hmm. And what does Consumers Energy, which is one of Michigan Radio's corporate sponsors, have to say about this issue?
The company says the money that it spent did not come from you and me, the ratepayers, that it came from their investors, and that it was supporting the money was supporting policies that are good for customers in Michigan.
One might argue that former State House Representative Gary Glenn might beg to differ.
Perhaps.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton. As always, Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He ushered in the $5 workday, the auto assembly line, the Model T. And 100 years ago this month, Henry Ford bought his hometown paper, the Dearborn Independent. And as journalist Bill McGraw spells out in a story published in Deadline Detroit, Henry Ford used his newspaper as a platform for anti-Semitic attacks. Bill McGraw is with us now. Good to have you back on Stateside, Bill.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we should note you live in Dearborn and you researched and wrote this piece for Deadline Detroit, giving it an online presence, this story, and also for a quarterly magazine called The Dearborn Historian. Tell us about a little bit about The Dearborn Historian.
Well, it was written principally for The Dearborn Historian. It's a quarterly magazine, just 30, 32 pages, that comes out of the Dearborn Historical Museum. And it's come out for quite a long time, a number of over 20 years. So I'm the editor, and it was the 100th anniversary of Ford buying the Dearborn Independent, and it seemed like an appropriate time to explore something that a lot of people know in general, that Henry Ford had anti-Semitic ideas. But the idea of the story was to bring into one article the various research scholars have done over the years and really give a full picture of what Henry Ford and anti-Semitism means.
And this story went up on Deadline Detroit's website last Friday. And then what happened with the Dearborn Historian?
Well, yesterday I was informed by people on the Dearborn Historical Commission that the mayor of Dearborn, John O'Reilly, had decided that the city wasn't going to send out this issue of the magazine. And it's obviously because of the Ford content, but I don't know any of the details, or I don't know why the mayor made that decision.
All right. Well, let's talk about your story. Give us just kind of refresh our memories. Give us a sense of Henry Ford's views about Jewish people.
Well, Henry Ford believed that Jewish people. He believed the various stereotypes about Jewish people that had been going around for hundreds of years before Henry Ford and that still are going around. In general, that Jews are conspiring to control the world financial system. And then secondarily, that they're also scheming and already taking part in plots to take over various American industries like the alcohol distribution industry, Hollywood films, even baseball and jazz. Henry Ford was very concerned about those things, and he bought the paper 100 years ago this month, and within about a year and a half, his paper was churning that out. I mean, Ford himself didn't write those articles. His paper did, the people he hired did, and the people he consulted with wrote the articles.
So Ford owning the Dearborn Independent gave him a platform to share these views, but he didn't have to do it.
No, he didn't have to do it at all. And then not only did they put out the Dearborn Independent, that actually was put out under Ford's name from about 1919 to 1927. The attacks on Jews came in a couple different concentrated periods, one that lasted almost two straight years and the other one that was a little bit shorter. But they took his, Ford's lieutenants took the content of all these articles week after week in the Dearborn Independent and put it into books, four volumes of books, which they titled The International Jew. And they spent millions translating those books and distributing them all over Europe and North America and even South America in the years after World War One. And as the article points out, many scholars, even scholars who have written books that are very sympathetic to Ford in many ways, acknowledge that his books had a big impact on Germany, including people who would later become members of the Nazi, not only members, but officials in the Nazi Party, and very disturbingly, Adolf Hitler himself.
Why, yes, you write about this, that Ford's Semitic, anti-Semitic views found a very appreciative audience in Adolf Hitler. How do we know that?
We know that from what Henry Ford told interviewers at the time, including an interviewer from the Detroit News in 1931. This is before he took power and before people knew what it was going to be like to have Adolf Hitler running Germany. So in what other scholars have determined from their studies is that Hitler was influenced, was heading in his own direction about anti-Semitism, and certainly was an anti-Semite before he read anything by Henry Ford. But Ford, in the early 20s, was one of the most famous people in the world for his accomplishments with the Ford Motor Company. And so he gave like some serious validation to Hitler's ideas, especially about Jews being responsible for all the world's problems. And again, David Lewis, who was a very sympathetic biographer of Ford, but he wrote very plainly in a book he wrote called The Public Image of Henry Ford in the mid-70s that Ford's writings inspired Hitler's early speeches about Jews.
And it's stunning to read your story in Deadline Detroit and realize that as Hitler's giving this interview to this Detroit News reporter in his office in Munich, here's a great big portrait of Ford over the desk of the future Führer, and he tells the news, "I regard Henry Ford as my inspiration."
Right, and I realize it's a heavy thing for a city to deal with when, you know, Dearborn is very closely associated with Henry Ford, obviously. I mean, his image is even on sewer covers in Dearborn. And so, how officials deal with that situation. One other thing involving Hitler that is fairly well known is that in 1938, when Hitler was in power and he had already invaded Austria, or at least his army had marched into Austria, he gave Ford a 75th birthday present, the highest honor that the Germany gave foreigners in that era. Ford accepted it, and it was quite publicized, and it created quite a storm of bad publicity for Ford, who, by the way, was really heavily criticized throughout the 20s by both leading members of the Jewish community, but also leading members of just of the United States, including two presidents. So his actions about this were very well known in the 20s and very, like I said, highly criticized.
And did it, considering, as you say, heavily criticized, and then thinking of in the immediate post-World War II era, did anything splash back on him to the point where he walked his comments back or apologized?
He did. He apologized twice, or he issued apologies twice. But both times he blamed underlings, and he claimed that he wasn't aware that this kind of content was going into a paper that was nicknamed the Ford Weekly or something, and was clearly owned by him, and people who were on the inside knew what was going on as far as the production of the weekly paper and how much Ford was influencing it. So both of his apologies, quote unquote, were widely scorned by both people in the media, politicians, and ordinary Americans.
I'm speaking with journalist Bill McGraw as we talk about his piece published in Deadline Detroit. 100 years later, Dearborn confronts the hate of hometown hero Henry Ford. And in your piece, Bill, you point out that these anti-Semitic views of Henry Ford are getting fresh attention these days. How so, and from whom? How are we seeing Ford's influence?
Well, that was the most stunning thing for me, that Ford, as a expert on hate groups in America who worked for the Southern Poverty Law Center, told me, Henry Ford is a living, breathing anti-Semite for haters in this day and age. And when you go on the various extremist websites like Stormfront, for instance, you'll see people discussing The International Jew. Those books are still in circulation. You can buy them. In fact, you can even go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble and buy The International Jew. And they really have given, the Internet age has really given Ford's somewhat dormant ideology a huge showcase in the 21st century. And he's, as this woman told me, the expert from the Southern Poverty Law Center, Henry Ford is just all over. There's thousands and thousands of references to him and the International Jew on these websites and Internet forums.
And as a matter of fact, to back that up, I went on to Amazon myself just to see, and I wanted to see what kind of reviews were there. And it was interesting. There were double the positive reviews than the negative reviews.
Exactly.
Give us an example of a review that really jumped out at you. What are people saying in these reviews?
Well, I think the striking thing, they say this pretty similar things. They say that you can almost tell that they appear to be young people, or at least maybe new to the movement, because they're discovering Henry Ford. And they're acting like, hey, everybody, have you guys seen what Henry Ford himself, who's still kind of a mythological character in America? And they're sort of like, again, using the fact that this great American is validating the views that they hold in 2019.
Circling back to the Dearborn Independent, as you say, which Ford bought 100 years ago this month, how long did that last, that relationship?
He bought the Independent in 1919. The anti-Semitic attack started in 1920, and he closed the paper down in 1927. And he closed it down after one of his targets in the later period when he was attacking Jews. He was an activist in the farm co-op movement named Aaron Shapiro. He fired back at Ford and filed a federal anti-defamation suit of some sort in federal court in Detroit. And it didn't come to court until 1927. Very sensational coverage. It was one of those trials of the decade. It was ended, though, by juror misconduct. So there was no verdict. Ford did, however, settle out of court with Shapiro, and that's one of the times when Ford issued the apology, and then he closed the paper down.
Back to the fact that you submitted this piece for the Dearborn Historian, so this issue is not coming out, and you're saying that you haven't gotten any satisfactory answer as to why from anyone?
Not that I haven't received a satisfactory answer. I've only heard kind of through the grapevine of people who are volunteers on the Dearborn Historical Commission. I don't think there's any question that the mayor decided yesterday that this issue wasn't going to go out. But again, I haven't heard from the mayor or any of his people, and it's fine. I mean, it's there. He's the mayor, and I'm just the editor of the magazine, but I just can't tell you why he made that decision.
And we should note that Stateside reached out to Dearborn Mayor John O'Reilly's office seeking some comment, and we have not heard back from him. Bill McGraw, his piece on the 100th anniversary of the Dearborn Independent being bought by Henry Ford and used as a platform for Ford's anti-Semitism, can be found at Deadline Detroit. Bill McGraw, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia. We'll be right back.
Artists create for all sorts of reasons: to express emotion, convey an idea, raise a political ruckus. For people who struggle with anxiety and depression, art can be a therapy. 16-year-old Kat from Holland is our next artist featured in our Creating Connection Michigan series. She tells us about how her time at Culture Works, a youth arts program, helped her deal with mental illness and rebuild her confidence.
All my life, I've dealt with pretty bad bullying. When I was young, I was beat up a ton. I was ridiculed constantly. In seventh grade, people would call me fat and disgusting and push me around in the halls. And I tried talking to my school about it, and they just basically gave him a slap on the wrist. They don't do that. And it actually got worse after that. So I tried to strangle myself with a jersey in the middle of class. It was more of a cry for help, but my best friend laughed at me and said, "That's a cute tie." I was totally broken down and so scared. I was looking for a way to still be on online school, but also have a social activity that I could do to try and get rid of my social anxiety and be more open with people after my huge bullying incident. And my first day at Culture Works, I was so nervous. I was on the verge of tears. But one of the interns came and talked to me, and she seemed generally interested in what I did, and that felt really great. People started opening up to me, and I felt actually a part of the class. The people here helped you grow with your art and learn with your art, but also feel better about your art. I really love to make emotions with my drawings, to put into my drawings exactly how my anxiety felt in a physical way and understand it a lot better. I call them mental monsters. The first one that I drew, I wanted multiple arms so that they feel like they're wrapped around me, easier to strangle me with, and sharp teeth to make that tingly feeling that I feel sometimes, and a shredded mouth because I feel like I can't speak a lot of the times. It feels like a giant elephant on my chest. My art helped me separate the disorders from me because I always felt like the disorders is what makes me me, but it helped me be like, no, that's not me. It's not me that I hate. It's these monsters that I hate. There was one day in my second photography class, and I felt utterly crappy, and I was actually feeling suicidal again, and I didn't want anything to do with anybody, but I forced myself to go. And at the end, I was feeling amazing. I showed one of my artworks that I was really proud of. One of my friends said, "I love it." So I felt really great. I feel a lot more wanted when I'm here. So I definitely have a lot more self-worth. My social anxiety would have just festered if I hadn't had any way to get out there. A lot of people outside of Culture Works will look at me funny because it's so conservative. But my friends here are different sexualities and love the hair and makeup that I have. And so I feel really happy here, and I feel like I can succeed. I'm not useless. Not just like a depressive blob. People encourage me and it feels amazing. People care about me. I feel like an actual person who can actually be happy and have a great life.
Mm-hmm. That was Kat, a student at CultureWorks in Holland. Our Creating Connection series was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions and funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And it is time for our standing invitation to you. We always want to hear from you. What stories are you focused on, or issues or people that you want to know more about? Let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and, of course, MichiganRadio.org. And just click the link that says Stateside. In the Upper Peninsula, there's a giant fungus living underground. It is really old, extremely large, and incredibly heavy. And it's intrigued researchers, particularly because of its low mutation rate. Let's find out more about this humongous fungus as we say hello to Johan Brun. He's a professor emeritus of plant sciences at the University of Missouri at Columbia. And he is with us now from France. Very good to welcome you to Stateside.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we talk about what has become known as the humongous fungus, that's a headline writer's dream, tell us the scientific name for this giant fungus.
So we published our first paper on this individual fungus back in 1992, and at that time we knew it as Armillaria bulbosa, and we claimed that it was among the largest and oldest living organisms. We never claimed to have found the largest or oldest living organism. The availability of new genetic tools allowed us to look deeper into the Upper Peninsula humongous fungus, and we began resampling in 2015. We're still sampling. The name changed, and now we know it as Armillaria gallica. And we anticipate that it will remain for the foreseeable future Armillaria gallica.
Where did you first find this giant fungus that we know is Armillaria gallica?
Right. So I was looking for the species Armillaria ostoi in this red pine plantation, and I found that there was a second species of Armillaria coexisting with the Armillaria ostoi, with the red pine pathogen. And that second species was the humongous fungus.
And it's in the Upper Peninsula.
It's in the Upper Peninsula. It's between Crystal Falls and Iron Mountain.
And you've been studying this individual for decades now. Give us an idea how large and how old.
Yeah. So this particular individual, which is essentially an individual in the sense that you're an individual and I'm a different individual. So this particular fungal individual, now we know that it's at least 2,500 years old. It weighs at least about 440 tons, and it covers or it occupies an area of at least, well, pretty close to 75 hectares, which is almost 200 acres.
Wow. That's big.
That doesn't mean that it's the only thing that's living in those 200 acres.
Sure.
It's coexisting with other fungi, but it has a presence spread out through that 200 acres.
And I my understanding from kind of reading up on it, this single specimen, it's coating hundreds of tree root systems.
Well, what it does, it's composed of, you might say, three different parts. It produces mushrooms every autumn for maybe 1 to several weeks. And these mushrooms are normal-sized mushrooms, and they're scattered around the forest. So one of the fascinating things about this is you go through the woods, and you see a little mushroom here and a little mushroom there, and you think, oh, here's a little fungus, and there's a little fungus there, same kind. But you don't realize that most of the year that species is completely underground, and you don't see it at all. And those mushrooms are like the fruits or the flowers of this massive underground organism.
Hmm. And age-wise, what are we thinking?
We're thinking at least 2,500 years, because we based the estimate of 2,500 years on the potential rate of growth of the fungus through the soil during an average growing season in the absence of competition. And the issue is that we know that there is competition and from other fungi for dead wood, which is the food base of our malaria species. So also we know that there have been times over the 2,500-year lifespan of this fungus when food has not been readily available, when the forest has been quite healthy, and during those periods the fungus would have grown more slowly. So we're quite certain that 2,500 years is an underestimate of its age.
Wow. How does that make you feel as a scientist examining this portal to ancient times?
Yeah, it really, it makes me smile, because there are so many surprises. We think we know our malaria, and then we encounter an organism like this, and we find out how much we have yet to learn about it.
What can we learn about genetic resilience from this parasitic mushroom, from this humongous fungus? What might be done with this?
Well, one of the reasons that we began studying our malaria anew, this particular individual anew in 2015, is that we wanted to know if it has a normal rate of mutation. How does it change, and how quickly does it change genetically over time? The 2,500-year estimate of its age suggested that it must be very genetically stable. And we had the tools as of 2015 to actually sequence the genome of complete isolates of this R. malaria. So we ended up actually making a map of mutations, or genetic mistakes, you might say, in the genome of this humongous fungus. And it turned out that mutations are almost unbelievably rare. Now, we weren't studying how the genetics of our malaria avoids mutation. We were just looking for mutations because we thought we could actually map the growth of our malaria historically in our study site.
And so here it's so incredibly stable, which is the absolute opposite of, for example, what we see in cancer genomes.
True, true. And at this point, we don't know why we have several hypotheses about why the R. malaria gallica individual may be so stable, but we haven't got funding, or we don't have an opportunity at this point to actually investigate which of those hypotheses or hypothetical methods of maintaining stability are the actual case. It could be that just simply because the fungus is largely growing underground through the soil and through decaying wood, that it's not exposed to ultraviolet radiation. But there are other mutagenic factors in the soil, antibiotics produced by bacteria and et cetera, that could conceivably increase rate of mutation. So we really, all we can do at this point is make intelligent guesses as to how the stability might be being maintained.
Well, certainly it seems there are secrets to be unlocked from this 2,500-year-old fungus that is sprawling across nearly 200 acres in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in a forest there. As we've talked with Johan Brun, who is a professor emeritus of plant sciences at the University of Missouri at Columbia. Thank you for sharing your work with us and introducing us to the humongous fungus.
You're very welcome.
With the partial government shutdown finally over, bills are being put forth by both Democrats and Republicans seeking to ensure that another partial shutdown doesn't happen again. We turn now to GOP Representative Fred Upton of the 6th Congressional District in Southwest Michigan. Congressman, you were one of a handful of Republicans who voted with Democrats in the House to end the shutdown. Why?
Well, lots of reasons why. We had a number of different bills. Many of them had nothing to do with Homeland Security. I support border security. There are a good number of Republicans and Democrats that do. But when you have individual bills that are dealing with agriculture or the Department of Labor or, I mean, you name the issue, that have nothing to do with Homeland Security, why are we shutting down those branches of government and telling hundreds of thousands of federal workers, stay at home, and by the way, we're not going to pay you, and your insurance may lapse, and who cares about the programs that you're running? I mean, literally at the IRS, and that was one of the agencies that was impacted, they have 5 million pieces of mail that was received during that time that was unopened. It's going to take a long time to get out of this mess, the 35 days that we were closed, and I was not hesitant to join with a majority of my colleagues and a number of Republicans as well that said, you know, let's move on. And I'm hopeful, I'm encouraged that the conference committee that's now set up with the House and the Senate can actually resolve this issue and hopefully end up with something that does include border security. And we'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
What do you think this partial shutdown accomplished?
Well, at the end of the day, there's no winners. Everybody lost, that is for sure. And, you know, as one that's been through some shutdowns before, it's always been the same. Unfortunately, this was the longest one that we've ever had.
And now we are hearing about bills being put forth by Democrats and Republicans seeking to ensure that a partial shutdown like the one we just had wouldn't happen again. What are your thoughts? Is legislation needed?
I think we ought to take a look at it. I'm actually a co-sponsor of legislation to do that so that we don't step into this muck again. I also co-sponsored bipartisan legislation that deals with workers' pay, particularly on unemployment. We heard from our governor as it related to that. Can you believe that if you are an essential federal worker that is forced to report to work and not getting paid, you are not eligible for unemployment. Yet if you're an non-essential worker who's told to stay at home, you are qualified for unemployment. So I introduced a bill that's bipartisan that deals with that issue. But the long-term scheme, I'm hoping that we can come together with legislation in both the House and the Senate that says enough of these shutdowns, nobody wins. Let's figure out a different system so that we aren't disruptive and not only send a pretty bad signal to all 50 states, but certainly around the world as well.
Would you support not paying Congress and staffs until a deal is reached?
Yeah, I will. And I was among a good number of my colleagues who, even though Congress was funded, I sent a letter early on and made the statement that if the shutdown continued, that my pay would be deferred as well. That was a no-brainer. But yeah, as part of this equation, to tell the White House and the Congress that they're not going to get paid, not a problem.
Looking at that deadline of February 15th when the short-term spending bill is up, what needs to happen between then and now to prevent another shutdown?
Well, I think, frankly, if you let Congress work its will, so maybe you take this out of the grasp of the individual leaders and say, let's have votes on these issues. Let's talk about border security. We've had, you know, President Obama supported building a structural wall. So did President Bush. If you let people vote their conscience on this, I think you can come to a bipartisan resolution that could pass in both the House and the Senate. We'll know more when the conferees meet for the first time a little bit later this week. But they've got 3 weeks to get their act together, and I sure hope that they can do it because there's going to be a lot of pressure from those of us that are not on the conference committee to get their work done.
Representative Upton, I want to shift gears to PFAS pollution. You were just named to that bipartisan congressional task force to address the threat of these chemicals, which certainly are felt to have wide-ranging health effects. We know that they're in our drinking water in sites in Michigan. And Politico reported this week the EPA will not be setting a drinking water standard for two of the chemicals in this report that will be out soon. What are your thoughts? How much do you believe the nation needs a federal limit set by the EPA?
Well, what Politico reported is frankly not acceptable. We need to know what the safe level of PFAS is. It's deemed right now to be 70 parts per billion. But if, in fact, that number should be lower, they need to tell us what that number should be. A number of states now have embarked on lowering it, some as low as 5 parts per billion, some are 20 parts per billion. We need one standard to know what really is safe. And I know that when EPA comes, you know, to whatever conclusion that they do, and that could happen literally in the next couple of weeks, maybe even the next week, we need to be on their case to say, you got to tell us what it should be. A number of us from Michigan, Dan Kildee, Debbie Dingell, myself, bipartisan, Tim Walberg, others in our congressional delegation wrote a letter last summer. And this was before a number of communities were identified with PFAS, asking, demanding EPA to tell us what that level should be. They need to do their job. That's why they're there. And they're not. I'm going to be one that's not going to let them shirk from that responsibility.
When you realize that standard, having a standard would let communities seek recourse from chemical companies like 3M, whose Scotchgard product polluted sites around Grand Rapids, certainly the Department of Defense, their firefighting foam usage has polluted military bases around the country, including the former Air Force base in Oscoda. How much does not having an EPA drinking water standard limit communities' options?
You make the point exactly why we need a standard. Most of us had no clue what PFAS was, certainly a couple of years ago. We do now, and we know that it's hazardous. We know that a number of communities, certainly here in Michigan, but around the country as well, have faced enormous strain, people having bottled water for months, questions about maybe their private wells, water systems, water that's in the river, even lakes. EPA has a role here. We support their funding. They need to tell us what's safe and not safe and not hide from the facts. And that's why a number of us on a bipartisan basis have insisted for months that they need to get with it. We need to know what the standard ought to be so that we don't have a whole quilt patchwork of different standards all across the country. And again, as I told EPA in letters that a number of us signed, if it needs to be lower, tell us. And you need to do your job. And we're going to demand that happens. So I'm not content with EPA sitting on their hands. They need to affirm that whatever that number really ought to be. And they need to get their work done. And I know that as a member of the PFAS working group, we're going to demand action once we know what EPA's resolve really intends to be, and again, could have that answer from them literally in the next week or two.
And some lawmakers, for instance, your colleague Dan Kildee of Flint, are saying Congress should act if the EPA doesn't. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at some point, EPA is going to be testifying. Mm-hmm. This is not an issue that they're going to be able to hide from. The acting administrator, will be up on Capitol Hill. He'll be testifying on their budget. We'll be having hearings in, you know, probably a couple of different committees, certainly the one that I sit on, Energy and Commerce. You could expect a PFAS hearing there in some of the subcommittees. And this issue is not going to go away until we get the right answers. And I'm anxious to see that unfold and to continue to put pressure on EPA to get the job done.
Well, we want to thank you for taking time to talk with us, and we will be, I'm sure, circling back to you again on this issue. We want to thank you for spending time with us on Stateside.
Yep, I look forward to it.
And to clarify, the EPA established 70 parts per trillion as the lifetime health advisory for PFOA and PFOS. And that is our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Stay warm, and thank you for listening.